I'm Ted Hunter. There's even more volume for this large space of Sound Law Center, who's been chosen by your council to hear and decide certain land use applications, including the ones that are before us today. When the land use application is filed, the professional staff of the city, the planning staff, reviews the application. They have done so today and have made a recommendation. I have that before me. Annie Hillier, who's a professional planner, is with us here in the hearing room, and she may give us some information about the application. When she reviewed it, she did that with reference to a number of exhibits. They've been numbered 1 through 22, and I have them in this file before me. The exhibits consist of the application, some memorandas regarding details of the application, emails from Annie Hillier, Jason Galbraith, and returned emails, a number of those. We have a survey, we have conceptual utility plan, we have a critical areas report and stream buffer mitigation plan. That's an important aspect of the application. And we have memos from public health and from Deputy Fire Marshal. All of that material that was reviewed by the professional planner to make the recommendation, those exhibits 1 through 22 are now a part of the record of this proceeding. The other source of information is from the applicant. We have applicant representative here today, and the burden of proof is on the applicant to show that these applications should be approved with reference to the criteria for approval that have been established by the City Council. If those criteria can be met or met with conditions, then the application is approved. If they cannot be met, it must be denied. In the hearing room today, just after 1 o'clock, there's no one else present other than city staff and applicant. So we can condense the procedure and make it even more efficient. Certainly not necessary to go through the entire staff report if the applicant has had a chance to review. Have you had a chance to review the staff report and its recommendation? Okay. And often the focus of a hearing will be on conditions, so we'll give you an opportunity to speak to the recommended conditions. I have some questions about the conditions, and if you do, we'll take those questions and we'll refine conditions as necessary to make certain the application can be approved. There's been no testimony, no submittals prior to the hearing that are really recommending denial, although we did have a citizen that raised some questions, I think, about it, that the Annie Hillier in her report spoke to those. This proceeding is being recorded, and if there's an appeal, it's based only on the record made in the hearing room today. The record consists of the exhibits that are admitted, now numbered 1 through 22, and any testimony that's given. Testimony must be given under oath or affirmation to help ensure the reliability of the record. We will ask now that the applicant representative and the professional planner please raise your right hand to take the oath. Do each of you swear or affirm to tell truth and testimony you give? If so, please answer, I do.
I do.
And we had a kind of a half swear-in, too, of you. I'm sorry that I didn't get you as part of the swearing-in. If you testify, we'll do so at that time. Okay, we'll begin with the staff report. And Ms. Hillier, it might be helpful if you focus on a couple of things that you went through as you reviewed this application that kind of gave you a little pause and said, I better look at this a little more closely. One thing I noticed was the building footprint and the analysis you did. We've been through a number of these recently, and it struck me that that analysis was very, very carefully done as to building footprint, not as 1,200 square feet, no matter what, but looking at what is the least impact available. Did I understand that correctly as you went through that?
Yes, I think so. And I think maybe one difference with this project is the size of the lot. So the applicant requested a zoning variance to increase lot coverage, and an RUE allows up to 1,200 square feet, but the underlying zoning did not in this case. And the applicant was also faced with minimizing impacts to the extent possible. So that's how I believe we came up with a slightly smaller footprint than the 1,200 that is allowed, provided zoning allows that.
Okay. And your analysis focused on the number of square feet of impervious surface area, so considering a driveway, and it would be longer with a smaller building envelope, so that resulted in, then, in the recommendation that you made.
Yes, that's correct.
I had a couple of questions about citations in your staff report, if we could take a real close look at that at this time. And one is the reference to the minor variance. I think on page 15, a reference is made to minor variances in Bainbridge Island Municipal Code, Chapter 1620, 160. Is that the correct citation?
That is the incorrect citation. Would you like me to find the correct citation?
Well, I thought it might be in Chapter 216.
That is correct.
So 216.060 would be the correct citation.
Yes, paragraph F.
And the other citation that I came across in reviewing the staff report was a reference to the Washington Administrative Code. And it looks like you have that up on the screen, as if you knew I was going to ask this question.
I apologize for that.
Well, that's very helpful, and along with that, first let's correct the citation, because it was made to a different section of the WAC, and that was, I forget what page that was on, but it was early on in your staff report, even on the first
the front page.
Yeah. So what is the proper reference? That reference, section 800.1b2.
It's, 197.11.800. 1B1.
Oh, so right nearby.
Yes.
And can you read what that says? For the location of four detached single-family residential units?
Yes. The following types of construction shall be exempt from SEPA review. The construction or location of four detached single-family residential units. And so the proposal is for less than that. So this proposal is exempt from SEPA.
And we had one in this room not that long ago. I think it was referenced as the Olson RUEX. In that situation, we had an MDNS prepared by the city, mitigated determination on significance, had some conditions. But not here. Can you explain the difference of why that is?
Yes. For the Olson RUE, that project was, the development was taking place directly adjacent a wetland, and only about 5 feet of space was proposed in between the development and the wetland itself. So I erred on the side of caution, thinking that there was the potential to impact the wetland in that case, and the exemption to SEPA, it does not apply when the project is undertaken wholly or partly on lands covered by water. So that's why that project went through SEPA review. This project is in a stream buffer, but the stream is located about 40 to 70 feet away from the lot, and it's on an adjacent or an adjoining parcel. So we did not require SEPA review, and I verified that decision with the Department of Ecology, and they confirmed that that was the correct determination.
Well, that's very helpful information. You already did look closely at it. Thank you for informing me of that. That, of course, doesn't show in the staff report, nor should it, but you did review it carefully and found that this should remain exempt, and primarily because it's distance away from the water. That would allow it to be exempt. Well, I was also curious, we have a couple of exhibits that appear to be applications. The first one I came across was Exhibit 4, and that had a 2017 date on it somewhere, but it wasn't signed, and it looked like it had been filled out online. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering why that would be included.
So,
because then the other one that I think is the one we're looking at today is Exhibit 9.
Okay. Yeah, I can speak to that. At the time of the pre-app, I was under the impression that the applicant only needed an RUE. And so he submitted for an RUE appropriately. The application wasn't signed, but the owner-agent agreement was, so I thought that that was perfectly fine. The reason there's another application is because I realized in reviewing the RUE application was that the applicant also needed a zoning variance, so I let him know that another application was required, so the variance was submitted afterwards. I didn't have Jason fill out a second RUE application, and that was an error on my part.
Oh, well, let's see if we can't correct that then. So the Exhibit 4 appears to have been dated maybe September 5th, or at least that agency relationship of 2017. And then we have Exhibit 9 in September 2018. Did you sort of combine the two?
I did combine the two applications.
Okay. So I'm kind of looking for the date of a complete application. Would you consider that then to be the September 20th, 2018, when they were combined?
That's correct.
Okay. And that's, I think, consistent with your testimony, because as you looked at the first application, oh dear, that's not really complete. Needs another application, so we're going to use the date of September 20th, 2018 as a date of complete application. And that also then would show that you're processing this within the time limits that are in state and local law.
Mm-hmm.
And as we're looking at these, I don't consider these to be any serious error of any sort, but as we prepare for hearings and do reports, sometimes things get left in from another report, or we quickly do it, and part of the hearing process, I think, is to look pretty close, as others will, applicant and others in the room, and see if there's a need to explain some of these differences. So I appreciate you taking the time to do that. And with those corrections and citations and the explanation about the complete application, my questions have been answered. I do have a question about a condition that you're recommending,
okay. But
we may get to that after we hear from applicant representative. So I want to give a chance for the applicant to present as well. Is there anything else you wanted to present as part of your report today?
I had prepared some slides, but it seems like you've answered your questions, or they've been answered.
If you've got slides, how many are there?
There are 7. I don't feel like I need to present them unless you would like me to.
They might be helpful if we can go through them.
Okay, that's fine.
We'll introduce them as an exhibit. Since you took time to do that, as is appropriate, let's make sure we have them as part of the record. We have Carla bringing them forward, and we'll mark these as Exhibit 23. Include these as part of the record.
Okay. Well, thank you, Hearing Examiner Hunter, for being here today. And thank you to Jason, the applicant, and Joanne, the project biologist, for being here as well. My name is Annie Hillier, and I'm the planner who reviewed this project. I have about just 5 minutes or so prepared, 7 slides. My plan is to first give a brief introduction to the project and the land use permit requests, and then I'll cover the staff recommendation and answer any additional questions that the hearing examiner might have. So as you can see, the slide's a little light on my screen. The subject lot is undeveloped and is located on the north end of Bainbridge Island. Its size is unique, it's very small. It's only 0.15 acres, or just over 6,500 square feet. If this lot was located in one of the city's densest zoning districts near the core, this would not be unusual, but this lot is located in the zoning district with the lowest density and the largest lots on the island, where surrounding lots are several acres in size, and the density is 1 unit per 2.5 acres.
How do you think that happened? Was it a subdivision some time ago that just sort of had an appendage, or what do you think?
I received information that it was transferred via a county treasurer's deed. I don't know how that came to be, and I'm not sure if the applicant has any other background about the lot.
Okay. So the information is it may have been part of an old right-of-way that just never really was kind of left alone, and now someone purchased it and is going to make some use of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that's an interesting background.
Yeah.
And that's why your testimony is it's a unique lot, surrounded by lots that are, what, 2.5 acres typically?
That's correct. The subject parcel is adjacent a fish-bearing stream, which is located on the adjoining parcel to the south. The stream requires a 200-foot buffer, which extends across the entire parcel. In fact, it extends beyond what the slide even shows. The only way for the applicant to develop the site with a single-family residence is through an RUE, as other buffer modification options provided in the critical areas ordinance do not result in a potential development site. The applicant is requesting a variance to reduce the front and side setbacks down to 5 feet in order to move the development as far away from the stream as possible. The two setbacks being reduced are shown on the site plan in red, circled in red. The variance is also requested to increase the allowed lot coverage on the site from 653.4 square feet to 1,020 square feet, or about 15%. Interestingly, the request for a variance could be seen to conflict with some of the RUE review criteria, including criteria number 2, which states, there is no reasonable alternative to the proposal with less impact to the critical area or its required buffer. It might seem that a house limited to 653 square feet would have less impact to the critical area, but upon analysis, it appears that this is not the case. A house with only 653 square feet of indoor living space would likely need to provide outdoor parking in a driveway rather than within the building footprint, which is currently proposed, meaning an SFR with 653 square feet of footprint would require a longer driveway to reach a house set back 25 feet from the front lot line for a total area of 375 square feet. The total disturbed on-site buffer area as a direct result of the driveway and the single-family residence under that scenario would be over 1,000 square feet. With a variance, a larger house could be created that can contain parking within its building footprint, and it would also allow for a shorter driveway. Together, this results in less impact to the critical area than without the variance, especially considering the pollutants that would be prevented from entering the watershed via stormwater.
Well, isn't that an interesting analysis? Mm-hmm. That's kind of rare, and that's one of the other reasons you referenced this as a unique property.
Yeah, I think so too. During my analysis described in the staff report, I found that the proposal can be conditioned to meet all of the variance criteria for review and approval, as well as the RUE criteria. For example, the variance is being requested because of special circumstances related to the subject property, the stream buffer, and the non-conforming lot size, and denying the variance for lot coverage would be denying the property owner of a substantial property right possessed by others in the same vicinity, where lot coverage maximums are over 10 times the applicant's request. And in red on the upper image, those are the lot coverage maximums of the surrounding lots. So you can see that they're much higher than the 1,020 square feet that's being requested. Mm-hmm. Additionally, the applicant has demonstrated that the proposed impact to the critical area is the minimum necessary to allow reasonable use of the property, and it appears that the proposal will result in no net loss of ecological function and values after mitigation activities are complete. In other words, the proposal strikes a balance between meeting environmental objectives and varying dimensional standards that at first glance appear to conflict. My recommendation to the hearing examiner is to approve with conditions the RUE for a total development area of 3,835 square feet as depicted in Exhibit 19. I also recommend approval of a reduction in the front and north side setback down to 5 feet and an increase in lot coverage to 1,020 square feet. And that's all I have prepared. Thank you.
Well, I think that's an excellent report. Very well prepared, concise, to the point, and touches on all the criteria. So thank you for going through that. And in under 5 minutes and with 7 slides. So very nicely done.
Thanks.
I do want to look at the conditions that you're recommending, because there are a number of them that show on pages 19 through 21 of Exhibit 1, which is your staff report. And perhaps what you can do is reference which ones you believe might be unique to this application. It seems some of them would be code requirements.
Mm-hmm.
But did you find that there might be a need for some that are unique to this application?
I think condition one is mm-hmm. unique to this project because it's calls out the specific square footages.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's no code requirement for minimum or maximum total disturbed area. The only criteria is that it's as little as possible. So I would say that is unique to this project.
And I'm curious how that's interpreted, removal of native vegetation minimized to the extent possible. Removal of significant mm-hmm. trees to the extent possible, and then those shall be marked, and those proposed for removal clearly labeled. Who oversees that? Because each of us would have a different understanding mm-hmm. of what's possible or what needs to be removed.
Mm-hmm. Well, my understanding is that a lot of the lot will need to be cleared to install, well, to put in the driveway and the house, but also the drain field.
Mm-hmm.
But to the extent that the applicant and the developer are able to, they will try to retain vegetation in those areas. And then I think there is a condition in here for fencing along. There's can you see where it says retain native vegetation on the slide?
Yes.
It's kind of pointing to the bottom of the south side of the lot, as well as an area to the east where not as much development activity is occurring. So there'll be construction fencing placed along that lighter green perimeter, and that will be an inspection as a part of the building permit. So native vegetation in those areas will be retained, as well as significant trees and any significant trees on the site that can be retained. Well,
so that reference to Exhibit 23, the last page that references Exhibit 19, that really defines the clearing area then,
mm-hmm.
doesn't it? And it's your expectation, in fact, you just testified that it would be reviewed during building permit as to the area that needs to be protected.
That's correct.
That would include, I didn't walk the site, I know where it is and went by it, but that's where the trees and native vegetation would remain,
mm-hmm.
in all of that area that's got the green slashing.
That's correct.
So it could almost be worded the other way, that native vegetation and trees shall be retained in that area. Is that saying the same thing?
Yes, in that area that's kind of outlined in the lighter green. It's not as clear on this slide, but it is depicted in the staff report.
Okay. Mm-hmm. In the staff report?
Yes, I think.
What page would that be?
On page 12, you can see where the temporary construction fencing will be placed, and that's surrounding the area where native vegetation is being retained. And then permanent fencing will be placed to keep the development area and the buffer enhancement area separate.
Okay, that is a clearer reference, page 12 mm-hmm. of Exhibit 1. OK, Okay, well, that's helpful clarification of that condition one. Mm-hmm. So let's continue with the other conditions. Which ones might be unique?
I believe condition 13A through I contains certain conditions within there that are unique to this project. This was the condition of the city's development engineer.
Let's take a look at that. The applicant shall comply with the following conditions mm-hmm. to the satisfaction of the city engineer. Is this drawn from one of your ordinances? Is that where you found it, or?
This, well, unfortunately, the development engineer who reviewed this is not here today, mm-hmm. But this is from one of the city's, I believe it's from the stormwater code mostly.
Okay. It includes some references to non-leaching materials mm-hmm. that, to the standard paved residential driveway approach, mm-hmm. detail DWG 8-170. Does that mean something to you?
That doesn't mean much to me.
Yeah. We should have a dialogue with the development engineer at some point. That conditions should be understandable to anyone that reviews them.
Okay.
And you might communicate that, because I'm not sure what that means.
Okay.
And I'm very hesitant to approve conditions that I don't know exactly what they mean. We can guess that it's a paving standard, but also underground utilities be routed in the footprint of the driveway improvement, use of a soil sterilant to construct the driveway would be prohibited. Which is interesting, because we have another condition where I think you're recommending that approved herbicides could be used.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll want to make sure if those are in conflict or not. And then minimal excavation foundation systems. These are very detailed. Are they, in your opinion, related to this reasonable use exception or variance?
Yes, I believe they're in relation specifically to the fact that this is an RUE request, and so a lot of these conditions have to do with LID techniques, which is adopted in code.
And you would not use these in other areas that might be built?
Well, you would potentially be able to use these if you were not in a critical area.
Okay. So the use of permeable materials, for example, in item G to allow infiltration, one would think that that's a common practice on any development site these days, but maybe not. I guess we need to find that
out.
And we're not going to delete any of these conditions, but I think open the dialogue. We did during the last hearing mm-hmm. about what is a minimum house size, and here it strikes me that these need to be just a little bit more refined by the development engineer. Here we have an item I, stormwater runoff from driveways controlled with water bars and berms spaced to disperse flow through neighboring vegetation per, I assume that's best management practice, T511 or T512 BMP. I don't know where that reference goes. Could you find those if you wanted to find those?
I could find these with help from Peter. And yeah. Peter's available. He has open counter hours 2 days a week, so he's happy to help people mm-hmm. when they come in. And I believe many of these are common for RUEs, so the Olson RUE, for example, had many of these same conditions.
Yes, it did.
Okay.
We just want to make certain we all understand them as it moves through the process, if there's no disagreement with them. And one purpose of a hearing, it's yes, to collect information, but also the dialogue is captured on the record mm-hmm. so we can come back to it and not have any misunderstandings about what those references meant. So that's helpful to have that deeper understanding. Okay, so those are the ones, 1 and 13, that you saw as unique to this application. I wanted to ask about condition 9. And that deals with use of herbicides, pesticides, or fertilizers. None may be used in fish and wildlife conservation areas or their buffers, except those approved by EPA or DOE and applied by licensed applicator in accordance with safe application practices. What was the thinking there when you recommended that condition?
I was pulled directly from the code. And because the application didn't detail whether or not that would be required, I felt that it was appropriate to include it as a condition.
You say from the code, that's the critical area?
That's correct.
Code.
It's in 1620.110.
Now, when there's an exception made and you might be in the buffer or closer to, is that only when this applies, or this applies in any critical area?
So it says critical, it says fish and wildlife conservation areas or their buffers, so it applies to the buffer as well.
And then when you look at an exception, you're intruding into that buffer, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So one might see a greater amount of impact and perhaps greater conditioning than what this would otherwise apply.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes, that does make sense.
Yeah. And here, and I confess I'm not familiar, but I certainly go to the hardware stores or the Home Depots, and there's mm-hmm. a lot of pesticides and herbicides that have received approval by our own Department of mm-hmm. Ecology, and even more so by the US EPA. And I'm curious if you think that any pesticide or herbicide or fertilizer should be used within the buffer. This says no, unless approved, mm-hmm. but you could just prohibit. Why would we want to do it? Or you could use what's sometimes mm-hmm. called integrated pest management, where you look first at hand removal and the ability to do that, mm-hmm. and maybe some limited machinery that can remove and only use mm-hmm. herbicides as last resort. Does that make sense
that makes,
to you?
Makes sense. I think if this had gone through CEPA review, we would have had a little bit more liberty to apply conditions that mm-hmm. might be a little bit more conservative when it comes to environmental impacts. But because this is allowed in the code, or using herbicides and pesticides that are approved by DOE is allowed, I felt like I didn't have the leeway to create a new condition.
Okay. I think you do when okay. there's intrusion into the, when we reduce it
okay.
by granting variances, that I think opens up at least the necessity to review. If you're coming closer to the stream mm-hmm. in this case, then perhaps there need to be greater protections.
Okay.
And something worth looking at, I certainly feel I have the authority to do that. And that's because your city council has given us clear indications they want to protect these, particularly a salmon-bearing stream. And as we know, you know, and I, it's common sense, mm-hmm. that the impact to streams is done by incremental actions. No one just comes in and wipes out the stream, but over time, gee, what happened mm-hmm. to that fish run? Well, it's each little action that's taken that might allow for some reduction of water quality or contamination or pollution of water quality. So I'm inclined to do something different okay. with condition 9. I don't want to shock your
okay.
department, but,
no, thank
but
you.
My thinking is something along the lines of integrated pest management, or at least my understanding of that, that would ask for first looking at, make some notes on that, mechanical or hand control, application of mulch, non-chemical method of control, such as cardboard and other biocontrols, and only then look into herbicides and justify why it's necessary. You know, blackberries are tough. I don't know if this site has the, we blame it on the Himalayas, but where they came from, I'm not sure, but, you know, you want to remove the blackberries. And have you done that on any property that you have access to, try to remove blackberries?
I have not.
Yeah, it's difficult.
I can imagine.
But many of us have learned that there are methods that don't require herbicides, or if herbicides are used, very limited application in the fall that allows that penetration into the root ball of the blackberries. So I'd like to look at something a little bit more stringent.
Okay.
We'll get the applicant's input on this, but that's my thinking, is to maybe replace that condition 9.
Okay.
Unless the city has strong objections to that.
I don't think so, because the code does allow, or does require, that impacts are minimized to the extent mm-hmm. possible. So I think that would allow a more strict condition.
Okay, thank you. So we'll put that out there. We'll get input and reaction from the applicant's team that's here. Well, Annie Hillier, thank you for your presentation. Very clearly done. I do appreciate the PowerPoint. I think it's helpful. It kind of brings your thinking together in a very concise and with demonstration of sketches that's very helpful. So we'll continue to do that.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Well, that is all we need from the city at this point. We'll give a chance to react to anything the applicant might say. Who will come forward now on behalf of the applicant? Please come to the podium where we can have you recorded in your testimony. And your name, please?
Jason Galbraith.
And what was your role with the applicant?
I've been working on this site for, it'll be almost 2 years in May. I'm actually purchasing this lot from the existing lot owner.
Mm-hmm. And what's your expertise?
I'm actually a realtor, but I bought my first piece of land when I was 20, almost 30 years ago. And I've worked on tough properties like this. Well, I've never really been able to afford a really nice piece of land, so I've always had to work on the tough ones. So I've worked with my biologist on other salmon buffer properties throughout the last 20 years.
Oh, okay. This is property you now own.
I will own. Once we get through this process, it's not
it's
a property I wanted
upon approval,
exactly.
Is it?
Yeah, it's the purchase contract is conditioned on getting approval from the city for an RUE and a variance.
It's a smart offer to make.
Well, and I can say the sellers have been very patient too.
Okay. So they,
do
you have a date by which that must occur?
It's moved. At first we thought it would get done probably within 12 months, but then we came across a new critical areas ordinance, and then also the city implemented a moratorium, and it wasn't until their third addenda to the moratorium that this RUE application was even possible for me to make.
Well, I appreciate your patience then, too. And you know you're in a jurisdiction that looks very carefully at development, and I feel that's what the city council has instructed their hearing examiner to do, is take that real hard look. As a realtor, I'm sure you've worked in other jurisdictions.
I have.
They're not all the same, are they?
No, they're not. So, and one thing I would like to say is that it seems like working with the city of Bainbridge, you may come across a hurdle, but there's usually a solution. You may have to take another few steps or readdress or rethink, but there's a solution. And so it kind of encouraged me to keep trying. So
good. You found a cooperative relationship, certainly with
Eddie
Hillier, and not a brick wall that's in
your
hand.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's been a learning experience. I've never done a variance or an RUE before, and I've learned a lot. And this is my first public hearing.
As Ms. Hillier testified, it's a unique piece of property, and if it's over-regulated, then it can be considered a taking. So the city, of course, wants to cooperate and not have to pay for the property. You're willing to go through that process and find the right balance with private property ownership rights, but also recognizing that there's a public interest because of the location near the stream.
Yeah, and this site is really unique, because when we first started this, we just thought we were going to do an RUE, and once we made that application, once the critical areas ordinance was adopted and we could go in, that's when we discovered that we needed to, well, one, they wanted me to move the house to the north anyway. Mm-hmm. And so to do that, we were going to have to reduce that side buffer, the north buffer, from 15 feet to 5. And then it was like, well, if we got to do a variance, then we might as well try to pull it forward as well, and we'll shorten that driveway.
Mm-hmm.
And but now I can't have outside parking to make the two. You have to have two parking spaces. And so then it turned into, okay, we'll make a shorter driveway, and I'll figure out a house plan to where we can make parking within the small building envelope. So it's been a process.
Okay. Do you think we're there now?
Yeah, I think it's. I'm actually pretty proud of it, and mm-hmm. you know that it's called a salmon stream to the south. I went onto the fisheries department. They have no records of any fish being spotted in that part of the stream. The stream actually, from that slide there, goes into an open ditch along Phelps Road, and then travels. What direction would that be? South,
mm-hmm.
Over 100 yards, where it then commingles with ditch water from the south as that flows north, and then it crosses over through a small culvert to the west side of Phelps Road through a brambles of sticker bushes, and about 1,000 feet down from there, the fisheries have actually spotted smolts and small salmon.
Okay, so there's a bit of a barrier then, is what you're thinking.
There is a barrier. And talking to my biologist, she explained to me why this would be considered a salmon stream or a fish-bearing stream, and it has to do with the fact, at least the way I understood it, was this: the road interrupts the stream, and so if the road wasn't there, it would have direct contact with the stream downstream to where the fish have been spotted, located.
Well, from what you described, and thank you for the detailed explanation, that certainly doesn't show on any of the submissions so far, but it does appear that any contaminated water would eventually flow to that area where fish have been observed.
Yeah, after it flows along the road, yeah.
So it's not that it's a fish stream where you would be directly having a negative impact on any fish, but contaminated water could eventually have a negative impact.
Yeah, and by the some of the rules or definitions of a stream, this area of the stream is dry, but it doesn't quite meet the health department rules as being a swale. It has to be dry from June 1st until October 1st, I believe. You can double check those dates. And this just misses it. It's dry like after June 15th and starts to see water again in the middle of September. So it's
dry for what period of time?
From about middle of June to about middle of September.
So as you learned about this, mm-hmm. the idea is that, yes, there's a technical classification.
Correct.
Salmon-bearing stream, but the reality is not at this location.
Correct.
For two reasons. It's dry for several months, mm-hmm. and there's some barriers downstream that just wouldn't allow there to be, or upstream, which direction?
Right.
It flows toward the...
Correct.
Where the smolts responded?
Mm-hmm.
All right, well then, thank you for being cooperative, and now here we are.
Yeah.
And what do you think? Did you get a chance to really look at those recommended conditions?
Yeah, I went through them. I had already been planning on putting a steel roof on, and that was one of their recommendations. I went and looked at the pin pile foundation requirement, and I spoke through email with Peter, the engineer, and he mentioned that he just wants me to do an analysis and see if that would be feasible. I personally don't think it could be, because we're trying to get the parking within the structure, and the way that pin pile foundation is set up, I don't know how you could do an underground parking within that footprint. Right. I don't know that it'll apply, but I'm happy to learn about it some more. And then regards to your comment about the pesticides, mm-hmm. wanting to adjust that, I would like to just say that one of the very first houses I purchased in my early 20s is an older home in Polsbo. And I would go to sleep at night, and I would hear this noise, and I thought I had a mouse in the wall. And so I called the pest guy the next day, and he said, well, you see any ants anywhere? I said, yeah, they're everywhere. He goes, well, those are carpenter ants. I said, really? He goes, yeah, you can actually hear them. And when I went under the home, there were actually piles of sawdust mm-hmm. in the foundation. So if you want to adjust that, I'd still like to be able to have traditional pesticides, I guess, just because of carpenter ant problems in this area.
Well, that's a very good point. And as we discussed it, I was not thinking of within the house, but applications on the land that then are maybe seep into the land and then into the water. But yes, I've experienced carpenter ants. You do need to use something to get rid of those.
And as a realtor, we see it a lot in my business. You see a lot of ant damage when homes aren't taken care of. Mm-hmm. So that would be my only comment to that.
Well, I appreciate you making that point, because it's not my intent. And I don't think the condition as is, or the one I was referencing, would affect the house itself.
Okay.
It's really within the buffer.
The buffer. Okay.
Yeah.
Understood.
That's a very good point. I'm going to make a note of that. We might even add that to make certain that it doesn't apply to the house itself.
Okay.
Okay, but with that assumption or clarification of certainly pesticides for house pests, other conditions then are acceptable to you on that list?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the driveway, and I actually looked at that drawing that he's referencing, Peter. Mm-hmm. And it's a normal driveway, so it's nothing that surprises me. Okay.
Is this, when you construct a house, is it one you intend to occupy, or will you?
No, this one, sometimes what I do is I find tough land and I get it ready, and then I'll have one of my clients build it. I may build this one myself.
Okay.
But no, I won't be occupying it.
Yeah. Well, that's good for you as a realtor. You're becoming more familiar with your regulatory structure, mm-hmm. and then you're better able to advise a client on obtaining property and what regulatory hurdles might be cleared. It strikes me your attitude is one of, we can get through that if we are cooperative and recognize that there is a public interest in the property as well as the private right to develop it.
Yeah, and that's, you know, one of my friends, he used to pound his table and talk about the Fifth Amendment and how we can't, you know, be too overzealous with some of these property rules. So, you know, we got to figure out a nexus and make it work together. So.
Well, that's a good reference. That goes right back to the 1789 Constitution mm-hmm. and the dialogues that took place in Philadelphia when adopting the Fifth Amendment as our first Confederation Congress did. And that put in place what, you know, we can kind of be proud of. We do have in this nation that balance of public interest and private rights. And that's why we have neighborhoods that everyone wants to live in, because
there are
the regulations that protect it from being otherwise disgraced. So thank you for your understanding. I think the implementation of regulations does rely in large part upon realtors, because you interface with people that are wanting to develop property. So that attitude and approach of let's make sure we balance this here is, I think, a healthy one.
Yeah, I do too.
Doing well. Well, good. Nice to meet you, and thank you for being here today. Did you have anything you wanted to add? You're here just in case some difficult questions come up, okay, or asking about what manuals you used or anything like that. I don't see any issues. I think it's a good report and provides some excellent guidance for anyone that does end up owning the land and developing it. So we have that as part of the record, and that will provide guidance. We've made some clarifications to the conditions. I'll carefully word it so it doesn't exclude getting rid of carpenter ants or other pests House, and we'll move it forward. And I'll do that within the next 10 working days, have a decision out. You've been patient long enough. Now it's time to, come on, get that decision out. And I promise we will do that without delay. Very good. Then at 1:50, we will adjourn this hearing for the day.